seems to be waiting for an answer. What? I ask.
It's amazing. I'm telling you, it makes me feel all warm and happy inside. The children call me their savior. I go around rescuing them from hunting parties and bounty hunters and all the others who are there to slaughter them. And in return, you know what they do?
This time, Elvis does the honors.
What? They love me. No, they worship me. I'm telling you, gentlemen, it's the greatest feeling I've ever experienced.
Alexei steps back from the edge of the pool as though he's said his piece. I glance over at Elvis. I can see he's just as confused. Okay, but I still don't get it, I tell Alexei. You like saving children. We have a way to save them all. I'm not sure what the problem is.
The problem is, what am I supposed to do once all the children are safe?
He smirks at the expression on my face.
Please, Mr. Eden, spare me the sanctimony. It's a game, after all, is it not? I pay great sums of money to be entertained. If there's no one left to fight in Otherworld, I'll be bored to tears.
But the children,
Elvis starts to argue.
Why would the children love me if they no longer need me? Alexei says.
And Fonz?
Isn't he wonderful? Alexei says. Such a great character. Milo Yolkin is a genius. I couldn't have designed a better sidekick myself.
I remember the love with which Fonz spoke about Alexei, and I hope he never hears Alexei talk about him.
So, is that it?
Alexei asks us, but this time he doesn't wait for an answer.
Thank you both for coming, he says.
And then he calls out in Russian to the men waiting outside the room.
What the hell?
Elvis cries. His face is ashen. Whatever order Alexei issued in Russian, Elvis understood it. And given the fact that he looks like he's about to shit himself, I'm willing to bet it wasn't good.
He just told him to kill us,
he helpfully confirms. Four men in pale blue scrubs enter the room.
I am sorry, says the Russian. Please do not take it personally, but I am afraid no one is allowed to see me like this. There would be blood in the water if word got out. If you had come to me with something interesting, I might have taken the risk, but Fonz already told me that this virus exists. Why would I let it be set free and put my own headset at risk? You didn't think of that, did you?
I didn't.
We could find a way,
I start to say. Alexei shrugs.
Don't bother looking. The virus is nothing that I need right now.
Wait!
Inspiration strikes as a pair of men come toward me. There is something else we can offer you, something that will keep you very entertained. I glance over at Elvis and tap the back of my skull. He nods. Alexei is intrigued. He lifts a finger and his men come to a halt.
What can you two possibly give me?
He asks.
Otherworld is all that I need.
We can give you your life back, I say.
More importantly, we can give you your dick back, Elvis says.
I'm not sure if it's his will to live or the little man-to-man we had earlier, but apparently he'll say just about anything to walk out of here with a headset. Alexei snarls as if Elvis just made a sick joke.
And how do you propose to do that?
The headsets you use let you see Otherworld, but the company has been working on a brand new technology, I explain. A disc that allows you to experience virtual realms with all five senses. If you're wearing a disc, you can taste, smell, feel, screw, Elvis completes the list.
Think of how entertaining that will be.
A long silence follows. Then, the Russian waves his men away, and they file out of the room. We've definitely got Alexei's attention.
I don't believe it, he says. If such a device existed, the company would be shouting about it from the rooftops.
They can't, Elvis says. There's a bug. Right now the disc can kill you. When you die in other worlds, you die in the real world, too.
Alexei snorts and throws up his hands.
Then why would I want to wear it?
He demands. We know someone who can fix the disc. I don't bother to mention that he's currently trapped in a virtual ice cave that could collapse and kill him at any moment, but I figure Fonz has already told Alexei that also.
And?
Alexei asks. We'll rescue him and have him build a safe disc. And we'll make sure only one of them ever gets made. No one but you will be able to experience Otherworld the way it was intended. I should shut the hell up now. I don't even know if what I'm promising is possible. Alexei is quiet as he ponders the possibilities.
You can prove that everything you've told me about this disc is true?
Absolutely, I tell him. How would you like to take a little trip?
Desperate people. The rest of the mansion may look like a branch of the CDC, but Alexei Semenov likes to sleep in style. If I melted down all the gold leaf in his bedroom, I could live like a rock star for the rest of my life. I see Elvis's eyes wandering the room, and I know he's thinking the very same thing. I just hope he doesn't get tempted to indulge any Robin Hood fantasies after Alexei and I set off on our journey. The Russian has been sitting on the bed watching television while we get everything set up. He does seem to be easily bored. He flips through the channels until he lands on a report about a man who was recently found dead in a Manhattan hotel room. The coroner's report said that the man's internal organs showed signs of damage that suggested he'd been badly beaten, but no one else had been inside the room. Not only was the hotel room door locked, footage from the security camera in the hallway proved the victim had been alone the night he died. Elvis and I are in the process of moving a bureau in front of Alexei's bedroom door when our host glances in our direction.
Don't get any ideas. If you murder me, my men will flay you alive,
Alexei announces calmly. I wouldn't expect any less of them, I reply as we finish the job. Is your bladder empty? I can't believe I'm asking a Russian gangster if he needs to pee. Alexei opens his robe and points to a plastic bag strapped to his waist that contains a few tablespoons of bright yellow liquid. I also get a glimpse of a few things that are even more disturbing.
My bladder is fine, he tells me.
I think he enjoys my discomfort. I produce the two sets of discs and visors that I brought to the mansion in case they were needed. Alexei looks down at them with disdain.
That is it? There's no other gear?
The visor lets you see and hear Otherworld, just like your headset would. The disc will engage your other senses.
No.
Alexei shakes his head and flicks one of the discs with his fingers.
This is some kind of joke.
I choose to ignore him. In a second, I'm going to stick one of these discs to the back of your skull, I say. Thankfully, he no longer has any hair to shave. You've been in the game before, so the disc should replicate your avatar and put you right back where it was the last time you left Otherworld. Where were you, by the way?
None of your business,
the Russian growls. Whatever. I'll find out soon enough, I tell him. I'll be wearing what we call the Master Disc. It's linked to yours. It will allow me to locate you no matter where you are.
Why do I need you following me around?
Alexei asks.
This will not be my first time in Otherworld.
I'd trust him, if I were you,
Elvis advises Alexei.
I didn't think I'd need any help either. Then Simon saved my ass in the first 5 minutes.
I left my avatar in the safest of places, Alexei argues. I will not need any help.
There are no safe places in Otherworld now, I point out. Semenov snorts with annoyance through the hole in his face where his nose used to be. He isn't used to taking no for an answer.
Maybe I will call my guards and have them take you away while I go on my own.
Sure, you could do that, I tell him, but I think you're far too smart to do something so stupid. You don't want to screw this up, Alexei. The Russian glares at me, as if deciding whether I deserve to die for my insubordination. Then, he smiles. His teeth are still perfect and pearly white, which makes the expression indescribably chilling.
Fine, he says.
He sits down on the bed and bends his head forward, exposing the base of his skull.
Put the damn thing on.
I arrive in Otherworld and immediately place my hand on the amulet that hangs from my avatar's neck. The world around me dissolves. Suddenly, I'm somewhere dimly lit and warm. There are wooden floorboards under my feet and pale green curtains hanging in the windows. I'd call the place cozy if it weren't for the female screaming at the top of her lungs. I pull out my dagger. Alexei must be nearby. God only knows what he's doing to the female he's brought here.
It's okay. It's okay,
I hear him say softly. I turn and see two figures together in bed.
I know who he is. I invited him.
The screaming stops. Alexei's avatar has the female in his arms, and she's peeking at me from over his shoulder. She's lovely, with long silver hair and green eyes that glow like a cat's in the dark. I struggle to keep the shock off my face. Alexei's girlfriend is one of the children.
You invited a guest here, Alexei?
She chides him.
What were you thinking?
Alexei doesn't answer. I don't think he's able. His head is buried in the female's hair, and his hands are gently stroking her back. He's smelling and feeling her skin for the very first time. Within a few seconds, his avatar begins to convulse. The Russian gangster is sobbing like a child.
What is it, Alexei?
The female asks.
What's wrong?
I search for the room's exit and locate it behind me. I'll be outside, I say, but I'm pretty sure neither one of them is listening. The house is little more than a shack, but it's well cared for and filled with lovely little touches and furnishings that appear handmade. I step out onto a porch. Alexei's home is one of the structures in the swamp between Imra and Nemi that Kat and I stumbled across on our way to meet Wayne. There are three little huts here, all built atop stilts. The swamp that surrounds me appears deserted, but I know there are creatures around. I hear them croaking and calling and scratching at the bark of the cypress-like trees. There's a loud splash in the water below, and I wonder how big the frogs get here in Otherworld. Then I remember the beast that snatched an avatar off this very porch, and I step back from the railing until my back rests against the cabin's wall. I smell smoke and realize there's someone already here. He's been waiting for me.
How about that? A man just got his life back. Goddamn beautiful, wasn't it?
The Kishka is standing beside me, a cigarette in his hand. The smoke curls up from it like a cobra rising from a snake charmer's basket. He takes a drag and sets a cloud floating out over the water. The Kishka's right. I was truly touched. It's hard to believe that the same man almost ordered my death. A couple of hours ago, I wouldn't have guessed there was a heart inside Alexei's mangled body. It wasn't until we came to Otherworld that I had any proof he was human.
I know what you're thinking,
my dead grandfather says. Of course he does. He's inside my head.
You're thinking, this is what those disc thingies should be used for. Am I right? To help people like that fucked up Ruski in there.
I can tell from the tone of the Kishka's voice that he doesn't exactly agree. Why not? I argue. If a Gubu finds a way to fix the disc...
You think the disc is the only problem?
The Kishka asks, walking over to the railing.
The human brain wasn't built to go back and forth between worlds. Come over here, boy. Have a look.
I join him at the railing and peer down at the water. It's a frothy brown that seems all too familiar, and it smells a lot like human shit. There's something swollen and white bobbing along at the bottom. I can't see it clearly, but somehow I know it's a body with its feet encased in concrete blocks. I blink and it's gone. The water's still murky, but it's now your standard swamp green. There's a fish of some sort swimming past. My worlds are colliding, and I'm dizzy and scared.
Things are going off the rails,
the Kishka confirms.
You need to get out of this place and stay away from that Russian while you're at it.
I can't, I say. Not yet. Besides, what's the issue with Alexei? You saw him in there with that child. I know he's an asshole, but he can't be completely evil. The Kishka looks at me with a raised eyebrow that seems to suggest I might be mentally challenged.
Evil? No, he's not evil. Your friend Wayne is evil. This guy's desperate, Simon. And if I had to choose between them, I'd go with evil every time. Mark my words. There's nothing more dangerous than a desperate man.
I sense movement inside. I check over my shoulder, through the window behind me, and see Alexei heading my way. The Kishka is already gone.
What's that smell?
Alexei asks when he appears on the porch. His avatar is dressed in the gray coveralls he always wears, and his black hair is neatly parted on one side. Alexei was a handsome man. In Otherworld, I suppose he still is.
Smell? I ask. Something was burning.
He lifts his nose and sniffs the air.
It smells like tobacco.
Oh, God. He smells it, too.
I have no idea what that means.
I wasn't smoking, I tell him. Do you think there might be someone else here? Alexei scans the swamp around us.
No alarms have sounded. We should be fine.
Alarms? I ask him.
You think I would leave my avatar here without the security system in place? There are children all around us. I protect them. They protect me.
You mean you kill guests and the children worship you? Isn't that the game you've been playing? Alexei ignores my comment.
You may use the headset, he informs me. It will be yours for good as soon as I get the new disc.
My ears suddenly detect a faint, rhythmic splashing in the distance, like the raising and lowering of oars. There's a boat coming towards us. Alexei must hear it too. He disappears into the house and returns quickly with a scope, which he puts up to one eye.
Our friend Fonz is on his way, he announces.
I suppose it shouldn't come as a surprise. Fonz knew we would both be here.
And it looks like he has brought me a guest. Our kind must be growing on him. Fonz usually kills all the guests he encounters, and I must say, he dispatches them in the most imaginative ways.
Where did you meet him? I ask. I can now see the tiny boat on the horizon. Fonz appears to be the craft's passenger. A large man has the oars, and the vessel is making its way towards us with impressive speed.
I saved Fonz when he was very young, Alexei tells me. I'd heard about the hunts in Karamojo, and I went to see what all the fuss was about. When I got there, I was disgusted. Muscular avatar shooting children with Kalashnikovs. Where's the sport in that? It's like using bazookas to kill Homiak.
Homiak?
Yes, what do you call them in America?
Alexei pauses and taps his temple.
Hamsters, I think. In Russia, they live in the wild, but only little boys ever hunt them. These guests are weaklings, I thought, killing unarmed Homiak. So I massacred all of them. Afterward, the children greeted me as their savior, which amused me. There was one child among them, a clever little creature with a tentacle for a tail. I was able to adopt him as a companion. He's grown fast since then, and he's served me well. I never expected to be so entertained by a computer-generated sidekick.
Those last few words feel like a sucker punch. I was actually starting to like Alexei. Then he had to remind me that the badass vigilante hero who travels around other worlds saving children just sees them as part of the game. As far as Alexei's concerned, Fonz exists only for his amusement. Is that really what you think of Fonz? I ask. You think he's just a bunch of code? If so, I hope the hell Fonz never hears about it.
God created men, says Alexei. Man created the children. They are no more our equals than we are gods.
It's almost funny to hear the guy talking about God without a moment's thought about what God might think of him. Kishka was right. I should never have wasted my time feeling sorry for this dick. What about the female inside, I ask him. The one who was just in your bed. Alexei's jaw clenches and his nostrils flare. I think I just tripped one of his wires.
She's different, he says.
Is she? Who gave you the right to decide who's your equal and who isn't? Alexei glares at me.
If it makes you feel better, I don't consider you an equal either.
No. Here in other world, I'm clearly your superior, I inform him. You're wearing a disc now, Semenov. If I wanted to, I could kick your ass into next Friday. The rules have changed. He stares at me with those icy eyes. I suspect he's imagining all the ways he'd like to murder me. I really hope he tries, but the boat is drawing closer. Simon Eaton, someone calls out cheerfully. It's definitely not Fonz. I have no idea who the hell it could be or what they have to be happy about. I wheel away from Alexei and turn back toward the railing. A tall, rugged man with a full beard is rowing in our direction. He's dressed like he's been living in the woods for some time. I bet he smells like he has, too. The canoe pulls up alongside one of the house's stilts.
You know this guest?
Fonz asks me.
You can vouch for him?
I honestly can't say if I can or can't. There was something familiar about the voice, but the fur-covered face doesn't ring any bells.
Simon, it's Marlowe.
Whoa. I can see it now. The avatar is an older, beefier, and infinitely hairier version of Marlowe Holm. Back in the real world, I was never Marlowe's biggest fan, but I'm absolutely thrilled to find out he's alive. So thrilled, in fact, that when his avatar leaves the boat and climbs up a ladder to the porch, I actually give it a giant hug. Elvis must be rubbing off on me.
How's Cat?
Marlowe asks, and I instantly let him go. I forgot the bastard had a thing for my girlfriend. Cat's good, I say. She made it out of the facility. She's awake and healthy.
Thank God. I've been looking all over for her in Otherworld, but no one's seen her since I arrived. I was seriously worried that Cat might have died.
That's funny, I tell him. While you've been looking for Cat, we've been looking for you. In fact, we still are. Any idea where the company might be keeping your body?
It's not at the facility?
Marlowe asks. The facility is gone. The company shut it down right after Cat escaped.
Then...
No, Marlowe shakes his head. I have no idea where the rest of me is. So, I guess you know what happened?
Yeah.
What I wish I knew is what to say next. Marlowe was brought to the facility the same night I rescued Cat. He'd been in a car crash, and the damage to his body was extensive. I don't know if he'll ever be able to use it again.
I'm not looking for an answer, Marlowe tells me. I was conscious until I arrived at the hospital, so I already know. I'm a mess. I was just wondering if you did.
How much does he know, though? Does he know that the company arranged the car accident that killed his mother and probably crippled him? Does he know that he's the last person being held in one of the company's capsules? Is this the right time to tell him? Fonz has just finished securing the boat and climbs up to the porch to join us.
Where did you find this man?
I hear Alexei ask Fonz.
Why would you bring him here?
I found him in Karamojo,
Fonz informs his mentor.
He's been killing the guests there. I thought you might like to meet him, so I forced him to leave.
He was very persuasive, Marlowe nods toward the gun that's tucked into Fonz's belt.
I apologize,
Fonz says.
It was the only way.
There's respect in his voice. The same kind of respect with which he addresses Alexei. I glance over at the Russian. I can tell he hears it, too.
He says he's wearing one of the discs.
Why have you been killing guests in Karamojo? I ask Marlowe. Alexei sneers as if it were the stupidest question he's ever heard.
Why else? for the fun of it.
Fun? Marlowe grimaces. I'm not sure that's what I'd call it. The guests have been slaughtering children. Milo cracked true AI, and the children are sentient. That makes all of this real. And these asshole players are out there shooting children like rabbits. You could have died in Karamojo, I point out.
So what? Marlowe replies. I had to do something.
He says it as if it were the most obvious thing in the world, as if anyone would do the same in his position, but they wouldn't. Marlowe's wearing a disc that could end his life at any moment, and yet he's devoted what could be his final days to saving a species that only exists in a digital world. Back in New Jersey, I thought he was just another douchebag whose life revolved around sex and drugs. Now, I find myself wishing my motives were as pure as Marlowe's. I'm not sure I'd be risking my life for anyone if it weren't for Kat. Alexei doesn't seem quite so impressed by Marlowe. He moves in closer, chin up and chest out. His avatar is at least a foot shorter than Marlowe's, and it's becoming clearer and clearer that height is not the only way in which Alexei is smaller. I think even Fonz is starting to see it.
Who is this person, and how do you know him?
He asks me. I love how Alexei assumes he's the one with the power here. If he wanted to be in charge, he should have chosen a burlier avatar. If we have to, Marlowe and I could take him out in a heartbeat. Wearing a bemused expression, Marlowe peers down at the smaller man.
I believe you've already been given my name, he says. Who the hell are you? And why do you keep interrupting my conversation with my friend?
Friend might be a bit generous. The only things Marlowe and I have in common are our discs and our shared love of my girlfriend. We're friends in the same way two tattooed bikers at a Republican fundraiser might be buddies for a night.
Calm down, gentlemen, I say. I know Marlowe from the real world. He's wearing a disc like us. The company has been keeping him a prisoner in Otherworld.
I turn to Marlowe. Alexei is a business associate. I need to borrow an Otherworld headset, and Alexei has one to loan.
And both of you are friends of the children, Fonz adds eagerly.
He obviously brought Marlowe to meet Alexei, thinking they might join forces. But from what Alexei's told me, he's not interested in sharing any glory.
I've heard about you. You're famous for rescuing children, Marlowe says to Alexei, doing his best to smooth things over for Fonz's sake. You must be thrilled to hear that there's a way to destroy all the Otherworld headsets. If it's true, the three of us could soon be the last guests in Otherworld.
Alexei rudely ignores Marlowe and directs his next question at Fonz.
You told this guest about the virus?
He's obviously not very happy, and his reaction has apparently taken Fonz by surprise. The child doesn't appear to have an answer ready. Marlowe fills the awkward silence.
So who's this genius trapped in a cave on the ice fields? He asks me.
He must find the scenario hard to fathom. James Ogubu, I tell him. Marlowe's jaw drops.
Butsara's dad? No way! He's alive? What's he doing here in Otherworld?
The same thing you are. He's trapped, I say. He came here with a virus that could destroy all the headsets. Milo caught him and imprisoned him in the ice.
The virus Fonz was telling me about is real?
Marlowe is suddenly very serious.
Apparently, I say. Then why isn't it out doing its thing? Marlowe asks.
I'm about to explain the situation with Butsara when my Russian companion decides to rejoin the conversation. I get the sense he feels left out whenever he's not the center of attention.
The man in the ice must make a safe disc for me before the virus can be released, Alexei says.
This time, Marlowe doesn't acknowledge Alexei. He's had enough, and I don't blame him. Nothing's more annoying than a disrespectful douchebag who keeps butting in.
What's this guy talking about? Marlowe asks me.
Alexei answers anyway.
That is the deal I made with Mr. Eden and his Ukrainian friend. They need a headset to take the man's daughter to see him. I have offered them a headset they can use. The price is a disc with the bugs removed.
So James Agubu is going to have to build a safe disc for this guy before the virus can be released? You know that could take a long time, right? Marlo demands.
Months, maybe.
Fonz looks to Alexei, who's avoiding his eye.
In months, the children could all be dead.
Alexei cannot be persuaded.
If the headsets are destroyed, I will not be able to visit Otherworld. That's why the debugged disc must be top priority. Once I have the new disc, I'll decide what to do with the virus.
You'll decide?
Fawn seems to be hung up on those words.
You'll decide what happens to the children?
I know what he's thinking, and I completely agree. There should be no decision to make.
I am the one who can give the man what he asked for, Alexei tells him. Without me, the man's daughter won't be able to see him. Without me, there is no virus to release.
Fonz is silent, but his normally stoic expression has vanished. He's been stabbed in the back, and his face reflects it. He just found out that the man he considered a hero is just another headset sociopath. The only difference between Alexei and the guests he's been killing is that Alexei got hooked on glory instead of blood.
You're a liar.
Fonz lifts his gun and points it at Alexei's head.
Don't be so dramatic, Alexei says. None of this is real.
Wow, this situation went downhill fast. Fonz, don't, I plead. I'm not sure he really understands what it means that the Russian's wearing a disc. If Fonz pulls the trigger, Alexei is gone for good, and so is my best chance of getting my hands on a headset. Without a headset, there's no hope at all of releasing the virus.
He won't do anything,
Alexei sneers. I've never heard anyone make such a simple phrase sound so insulting. Fonz's arm shakes and his lip quivers. His world has crumbled. His hero is a fraud. But he doesn't look able to shoot. When the gun falls from Fonz's hand, Marlo quickly kicks it out of reach, and Alexei starts to laugh. This time, the tentacle responds. It whips around and whacks the Russian's avatar in the stomach, slamming Alexei back into the cabin's wall. Then, Fonz turns and dives over the railing and into the murky water below. I watch for his head to surface, but it never does. I glance back at Alexei, who's curled up in the fetal position on the wooden porch. I'm glad he's alive, but I hope it hurts like hell.
Well, that was unexpected. Marlo deadpans behind me.
The headset. I open my eyes and have no idea where I am. It's becoming such a regular occurrence these days that I'm not even freaked out. All I know is that I'm staring at a lovely ceiling and my body is comfortable for the first time in ages. Where the hell am I? I wonder out loud, and someone beside me laughs.
You're at the Waldorf Astoria Hotel, Kat says.
I remember how we got here. Dropped off in a black sedan driven by a silent Russian. One of Alexei's men had called ahead and booked a suite at the hotel. Another escorted us inside, and I'd be willing to bet that's the only reason the hotel doorman let four dirty and bedraggled teenagers enter. I would have preferred to stay somewhere a little less fussy, but Alexei insisted the Waldorf Astoria was the safest place to be. The Chinese government owns the hotel, and Chinese tech firms have long been the company's biggest rivals. If they end up spying on us, which is highly likely, they'll probably like what they hear.
The Waldorf Astoria is the best realm of all, I tell her, pulling the covers up over our heads. Can we stay?
You have no idea how awesome it is, Kat tells me. There's bacon in the living room. And the internet.
The internet, I joke. Though to be perfectly honest, it's hard to imagine such luxuries. How long have you been up?
Hours, she says. I told the others to let you sleep. It's going to be a very long day for you. But if you get Busara to her dad, it could be the last trip any of us have to make.
We keep hoping every trip will be the last one, and it never turns out that way.
but I don't think it would be helpful to say so.
So the delivery came, I ask.
Half an hour ago, Cat tells me. Bussara is bouncing off the walls.
Let her bounce, I say, pulling Cat toward me. You can't rush recovery.
I must have been too tired to appreciate the suite's living area last night. The decor is a little too frilly for my taste. Lots of flowers and silk. You could call the style rich grandma. In fact, before she died, my dad's mother lived in a house that looked an awful lot like this. I was hardly allowed to touch anything there. The memory makes me want to jump on the couch cushions or play catch with a vase.
What have you guys been doing? Cat, you were supposed to get him up, Bussara cries as we emerge from the bedroom. It's been an hour.
I was really tired, I tell her, pretending to yawn to cover my grin.
Totally exhausted, Cat adds.
I see Elvis smirking on the sofa, a tablet computer in his hands.
So, do you think you got enough rest? He asks. If so, come over here. I've got something to show you.
I grab a piece of cold bacon off the room service cart and plop down beside him. The second I get a glimpse of what's on the iPad, I straighten up again. A video is on pause, and the word Other Earth is written across the screen.
It's a new ad, Elvis says, handing me the tablet. Go ahead. Hit play.
It's a point-of-view scene of a man running through Central Park. The only thing you can see are his fists pumping, but you can tell from his sleeves that he's wearing a dark gray suit. There's a gun clenched in one of his hands. He flies past joggers and strollers and old ladies with dogs. You can hear the air being sucked into his lungs and his heart pounding in his ears. Seeming to catch sight of something, the man changes course and charges down an empty path through the woods. He's alone in the forest when he comes to a sudden stop. Something has appeared on the path in front of him. A massive beast, bipedal yet reptilian, with a mouth that's mostly teeth. The man raises his gun as the creature hurls itself toward him, pumping three bullets into its chest in quick succession. Stone dead, but still moving forward as it falls, the beast skids to a stop at the man's feet. The man gives the creature a kick to ensure that it's been eliminated. Then he lifts his hand to his face and removes a pair of glasses. In an instant, his suit sleeves are gone, as is the gun, and the beast on the ground has vanished into thin air. A female jogger passes by on the path. When she doesn't seem to notice anything out of the ordinary, it becomes clear. Our hero is just a jogger, too. The man puts his Other Earth glasses back on, and the dead beast reappears. In the distance, there's another one. The man starts running again, and the commercial ends.
Other Earth, says a voice that sounds a lot like Tom Cruise.
Your world, only better.
It's augmented reality, just like I thought, Elvis says. They've turned New York City into a giant sandbox. That's why they needed such detailed maps. I'm sure the rest of the country will be playable soon.
So Other Earth is going to let everyone in New York star in his own private action movie? I ask. I can only imagine what that's going to be like.
What do you want to bet? That's not the only kind of movie you can star in, Elvis says, waggling his eyebrows.
Pervert, Bussara is standing over us.
How would you know? Elvis asks.
There's something weird going on between the two of them, and I have no interest in being in the middle of whatever it is.
I glance down at the tablet and scroll through a list of suggested videos. It's mostly company-related news clips. Engineer locked in office found dead by security. Heart attack claims company genius. The guy in question looks young for a heart attack. If only it could have been Todd.
Simon, we may not have Semenov's headset for much longer, I hear Bussara plead. Can we please get started?
She's right. And for once, she asks nicely. I grab some more bacon and hand the tablet back to Elvis. It's time to take Bussara to Otherworld. The headset wasn't the only thing that was delivered this morning. An omnidirectional treadmill has been set up in one of the bedrooms, and an adorably juiced-out Russian who appears to speak less than 10 words of English is standing guard outside our suite. I understand Busara's impatience, but she's already driving me nuts. She hasn't been to Otherworld since the 2,000 new players arrived. She has no idea what to expect, and yet she refuses to listen. I'm still chewing my bacon when she jumps on the treadmill. Her haptic booties are already on. The gloves come next. I don't even have a chance to put on my disc before Busara slipped on the headset. "Do I really have to go with her?" I complain to Kat. "No," Kat says reasonably. "I could go instead." "Never mind," I reply. "That's the last thing I'd want."
"I'll go," Elvis offers, and I opt to ignore him.
"Talk to Agubu's avatar," Kat tells me. "Then we'll find his body, rescue Gorog and Marlo, make a safe disk, release the virus, take down the company, and live happily ever after."
"Well, when you put it like that, it all sounds totally doable," I joke.
She kisses me.
"Then go do it."
Cursing, I slap on my disk and go under. I arrive at the gates of Imra, just in time to see the Clayman appear. Busara's avatar looks exactly the same as the last time I saw it, with one exception. The amulet that once dangled from the Clayman's neck is now hanging around mine.
"What's it feel like?" I ask her.
"Different," she says in her own voice.
"Did you get a gun, like I told you?" I ask.
She shows me the handle of a pistol that's tucked into her waistband.
"That puny thing?" I ask. "Are you sure that's not some kind of toy?"
Busara's not having it.
"I don't want to be weighed down by a bulky weapon. Let's go," she says.
We set off toward the ice fields. The tall, thin Clayman's stride is much longer than mine, and I have to jog a little to stay beside her. But the Avatar's height comes with its disadvantages, too. We're less than a mile into the red wasteland between the ice fields and Imra when a shot rings out. The Clayman flashes. I crouch behind a small boulder and scan our surroundings for the shooter. There are several rocks in the distance that are large enough to hide someone. Busara's avatar looks far more confused than concerned.
"What just happened?"
"Get down," I order. "You've been shot."
"I have?"
she asks as a second bullet whistles through the air and lodges itself in her avatar.
"I didn't feel a thing."
The Clayman flashes for a second time. I see the glint of metal in the sun. There's a sniper 100 yards away. I couldn't possibly reach him with my dagger. Busara pulls her gun and points. By the time she's gotten a bead on the guy, her avatar flashes, and the Clayman is dead.
"Shit,"
I mutter. I take hold of the amulet around my neck, and in an instant, I'm back at the gates of Imra. I'm starting to worry that something may have gone wrong when an avatar appears before me. It looks like a giant Mr. T.
"Let's go," it says in Busara's voice.
"Don't you think this would be a good opportunity to talk survival strategies?" I ask her.
"We can't afford to waste any more time," she says.
"Hold on a second," I shout at her back. "I wasn't the one..."
"Save your lecture for later," she tells me. "I got it under control now."
I have no idea what time it must be back in the real world. I wouldn't be surprised if we'd been in Otherworld for more than 12 Earth hours. Here, it's been days. Busara's avatar has been murdered 3 times and fallen through the ice where it was ripped apart by sharks. Once we made it within eye shot of the ice cave before a mutant bear devoured her. At first, I found the carnage amusing. I'd use the amulet to send myself back to Imra and wait for her to show up again with an all-new avatar, but the novelty wore off ages ago. Now I'm exhausted. Busara's wearing a camouflage suit now, like the one Kat chooses, and the face looking out from its hood is her own. The machine gun slung across her avatar's back is the deadliest weapon available in Otherworld. She shoots first now and asks questions later. We've mown down 6 guests and 3 mutant bears, including the beast that ate her earlier. I'm about to collapse by the time we reach the entrance of the ice cave, and I'm not the one with a heart condition. But if Busara's feeling weak, she's doing a great job of hiding it. She sprints into the ice cave on her own. Figuring she'll probably want a little privacy, I sit down with my back against the tunnel wall. My eyelids are drooping and my ass is freezing. I'm half asleep when Busara screams. I should have known better than to let her go in alone. I don't have the strength to start all over again. I run toward the chamber at the end of the tunnel. As I reach the end, I can see Busara. Her hood is off, and she's fallen to her knees, but she appears uninjured. When I realize why she screamed, I feel like joining her. The ceiling of Magna's throne room has collapsed. I can't imagine how many tons of ice have fallen, but I know nothing underneath could have survived. Though a rescue effort is hopeless, I rush to where the entrance to the throne room once was. My mind is too busy spinning to start contemplating our next move. I'd rather cry like the girl on the floor behind me. Then I spot it. A glint of metal in the stream of melted water that flows along one side of the tunnel. I drop to my knees and fish out the object. It's a gun, and I've seen it before. I never forget a weapon that's been shoved in my face. "I don't think your dad is dead," I tell Busara. "What?" She spins around to face me. "Then where is he?" She freezes when she sees the gun in my hand. "I think Fonz has him," I say. "This is his gun. I'm not sure it's good news." Busara's avatar dims. I have no idea what's going on. Then, my eyes are flooded with light. My disc has been removed. "How could you let this happen?" Busara is shouting at me. As my eyes begin to focus, I see Busara being held back by Elvis and Kat. My disc is in her hands. "What the hell? How is this my fault?" "You took that thing with you to the ice cave, didn't you?" she demands. "He would never have known about my father if it weren't for you." Elvis grabs her and puts his arms around her as if it's the most natural thing in the world. I expect her to punch him, but she doesn't even squirm.
"Busara," Elvis says gently, "Fonz isn't going to hurt your dad."
"How do you know?" she cries with her face against his chest. I'm trying my best to follow the discussion, but I can't quite believe what I'm seeing.
"Because your dad built the virus," Elvis tells her, "and that's all Fonz wants. From what Simon and Kat have told us, he doesn't sound like such a bad guy."
You know things are totally screwed up when Elvis is acting as the voice of reason. Suddenly, Busara pushes Elvis back, and things between them return to the way they were. Elvis is hurt, but Busara can't see it. A few seconds ago, she was in his arms. Now, she won't even look in his direction.
"Do you really think Fonz can keep my father alive in Otherworld?" she argues. "My dad's wearing a disc, and he's never played a game in his life. I died 5 times before I made it to the cave."
"Yeah, because you refused to listen," I snap. "Why don't you do us all a favor and start listening now?" Busara glares at me but doesn't say a thing. I'm so goddamn sick of her. I spend countless hours trying to keep her alive in Otherworld, and she repays me by abusing my best friend and giving me shit about something that's hardly my fault. I hear Kat take a deep breath.
"Okay, guys," she says. "I think the first thing we need to do is get the hell out of the Waldorf Astoria."
Damn, I was really starting to get used to it here.
"Why?" Busara demands. "I say we go right back to Otherworld and start looking for Fonz."
"May I remind you that we made a deal with a Russian gangster?" Kat says, keeping her cool. "He lent us the headset in exchange for a safe disk. If there's any chance that we won't be able to pay him, we need to be someplace where he can't find us."
"Oh, come on. We've got plenty of time before Alexei comes after us," Busara says.
"Unless Fonz makes your dad release the virus," I point out. "Then Alexei is going to be super pissed."
"If my dad didn't tell you where the virus is, he's not going to tell Fonz either," Busara argues.
She has a point. Back in the ice cave, Fonz even threatened to kill James Agubu, and the Avatar still refused to give up the virus's location. Elvis has been uncharacteristically quiet. Finally, he chimes in.
"Maybe there is something we can give Alexei," he says. "It's not exactly what he wants, but it's a good down payment. It might buy us some time while we look for Busara's dad."
"What is it?" I ask. I have no idea what it could be.
"We can give Alexei the entire company," Elvis says.
The sterile white room is empty, aside from a hospital bed and several large machines. Alexei lies there, tucked under a sheet. IV tubes sprout from his arms, and a monitor is sketching the beats of his heart. He looks like he's sleeping. I see the disc and visor he borrowed lying on his bedside table. As I slip them into my pocket, Alexei's lips part.
"How long?"
he croaks. "I'm not sure I understand," I respond.
"How long will it take him to build the safe disc?"
Alexei's eyes open. They're the same piercing blue eyes that he gave his avatar. The face that surrounds them couldn't be more different. I know I should tell him we're still looking for Agubu's avatar. I once overheard my mother advise a client that you should tell the truth whenever you can. Unnecessary lies come back to bite you. But the Kishka was right about Alexei. The last thing a man this desperate wants to hear about is a setback. First, we need to locate James Agubu's body in the real world. Once he's free, it may take him a few weeks to fix the disc. Alexei shakes his head emphatically, and the blips on his heart monitor speed up.
"That's too long. I cannot stay like this."
He presses a button on the side of his bed, and the top half folds forward. He's still halfway to a sitting position when his face contorts in agony, and he's forced to stop. I don't see any external injuries, but I can only imagine what kind of damage getting whacked by Fonz's massive tail might have done to his internal organs. "I had no idea you were so badly hurt," I say. "If Fonz were here, I'd give his tentacle a high five."
"I was hardly a perfect specimen to begin with."
It sounds like a joke, but his voice is deadly serious.
"I need that disc, Mr. Eden."
"I know," I tell him, "but..."
"You know?"
He spits back at me.
"You know what it's like to be half a human? To be robbed of your face and your manhood? Yesterday I got them both back for a few precious minutes. Now I'll do whatever it takes to keep them. Tell Mr. Agubu to work faster. I will pay him whatever he likes."
"Yeah, I'm afraid there's a bit of a problem with that." Now for the tricky part.
"If there's a problem, I know you can fix it, Mr. Eden,"
Alexei says. It's not a vote of confidence. It's clearly a threat. There's something our engineer is going to need before he can get started.
"Whatever it is, buy it."
"It's not that simple," I tell him. "There's a 13-year-old boy named Declan Andrews. His avatar died in Otherworld while he was wearing a disc. But somehow, his real-world body survived. He's the key to making a safe disc."
"So," Alexei says, "find him. Pay his parents to let us adopt him, or babysit him, or whatever the hell they want. Kidnap the child if necessary."
"The company has Declan," I tell him. "They know he's the key to fixing the disc. But the two people who designed the technology are both gone, and the company doesn't have the brain power to get it done." I can see Alexei's thumb circle the call button on the side of his bed. I have a strong hunch I'll be in serious trouble if he decides to push it.
"You left this part out when we made our deal, Mr. Eden. You did not say there would be a second person to find. This boy is very important. You expect the company to hand him over if I call and ask nicely?"
"Sure," I say. "If you're in charge." The plunge. Partnering with Russian oligarchs does have its advantages. I'm in the passenger seat of a helicopter flying over New York Harbor. The Statue of Liberty is just below. She seems impossibly close, like I could reach out and touch her. Dozens of watercraft, from tiny motorboats to giant cargo ships, crisscross the water. We're only interested in one of them. Directly below us is the Staten Island Ferry. Its bright orange paint makes it impossible to miss. It took us a while to agree on the site of Milo Yolkin's final plunge. There were countless factors to consider. It had to take place somewhere the body wouldn't be found, so no midtown office buildings. There needed to be lots of people around with cameras ready. And we had to be able to make a quick, clean escape. The moment videos are posted, The company will know exactly where we are. On the ferry's last trip across the harbor from Staten Island, Bussara and Elvis planted the projector at the back of the boat, just past the railing. They disembarked in downtown Manhattan, and we waited for the ferry to set off on its return trip. As it pulled back from the dock, Kat and I took off from a heliport atop a Wall Street skyscraper. We need to be within 200 yards of the projector for the controls to work properly. "Okay," Kat shouts. She's watching the ferry with powerful binoculars. "Switch him on!" I bring Milo Jochen to life and let him stand motionless for several seconds. The timing of his plunge has to be perfect. This is Milo's final public appearance, and we need people to see him. The projector will be destroyed when he goes over the side. "A woman is pointing," Kat announces. "She's got her camera up. More people are moving in. Now!" I roll the sphere off the deck and into the water below. Milo Jochen goes with it. Seeing the action from this high up isn't nearly as fun, but none of us want to be anywhere near that boat when it eventually makes it to land. I'm sure someone down there is screaming for help. I watch tiny people rush out onto the ferry's deck. Soon, everyone on board is clustered at the railings. The boat slows down and crew members make their way through the crowd. An alert has gone out. Nearby vessels are turning back toward the ferry, and a police boat is already racing toward it. "Check Twitter," Kat tells me. I put down the controls and pick up the burner phone that our new partner has provided us. There's already a photo of Milo's fatal jump. It seems the person who took the picture didn't know who he was, but two other people have already replied with the correct identity. "Let's go," I tell the pilot. Our work is done. We're almost back at the heliport when three black helicopters race past us, the company's silver logo blazing in the sunlight. A tourist from Melbourne captured it best. She was filming the skyscrapers of Lower Manhattan as the ferry left them behind. Suddenly, a figure rises into her camera view. He stands motionless for a second or two, as if contemplating the waves below. He's wearing the hoodie and sneakers that have become Milo's calling card over the last 10 years. Blonde curls form a halo around his head. He turns and looks over his shoulder just long enough to leave no doubt whatsoever concerning his identity. Then he steps forward and disappears over the side. There are screams and shouts for help in the background as the camera rushes forward, the city bouncing in front of it. The next clear shot is one of the water below. It's dark green and murky, and the wake of the ferry is outlined in white foam. The camera pans to the left, then frantically to the right. There's no sign of the person who leaped to his death. I wonder where Milo's real body is. What did the company do with it after they stole his palm print? Is he buried in an unmarked plot, wrapped in plastic and stored in a freezer, turned into ashes that drift through the wind? How could a man so important just vanish and be missed by so few? Aside from Kenji, his ninth-grade buddy, did anyone know who Milo Jochen really was? What was the difference between the man we saw on television and the hologram that just sank to the bottom of New York Harbor? There are 4 rooms in our suite at the Waldorf Astoria, and there's a television in each. Every channel from CNN to Al Jazeera is covering Milo Jochen's suicide. As the hours pass and all hopes of finding the boy genius alive begin to dim, the financial reporters start taking over. Milo's death may be tragic, but the fate of the company is beginning to look even bleaker. The stock has already hit its lowest point in a decade, and the bottom appears to be nowhere in sight. All the cable news channels are at the scene. New York Harbor is crowded with police boats. There's so many helicopters churning the waters, you'd think we were in the middle of a hurricane. The anchors are still holding out hope on CNN, while MSNBC and Fox have pretty much declared Milo dead. They're running a reel of highlights from his lifetime and comparing his death to Kurt Cobain's suicide. Reports from New Jersey show the bizarre scene taking place in front of a nondescript house in Sunset Heights. It's part Burning Man, part Irish Wake. Aside from the kid watching it all with disgust, no one seems to have figured out that Milo Jochen never lived there. While the world mourns, stock of Milo Jochen's company is being snatched up at pennies on the dollar. The Inner Circle.
Mr. Eden, the handsome secretary announces my arrival.
6 middle-aged men rise to greet me, all of them creepy AF.
5 are wearing bespoke